Well, good morning. It's 11 o'clock on the 27th of March, 2025. Green Zine, Henry Swayze is back. He's going to be joining me in just a little bit. Hey, we're going to let you know about an event that's coming up pretty soon that I think you would be very interested in. Then we've got some music. We've got Bird Note. We've got a jam-packed show. But take a listen to this and see if you can join us on the 6th of April here at the Vermont Law and Graduate School. LGS's Native American Law Students Association join Royalton Community Radio in presenting Rumble, the Indians Who Rock the World. This award-winning music documentary features numerous indigenous musicians, including Link Ray, Robbie Robertson, Mildred Bailey, Charlie Patton, Buffy St. Marie, Jimi Hendrix, and others. This is a free community screening on Sunday, April 6th in Oaks Hall on the campus of the Vermont Law and Graduate School in South Royalton. Further information at our radio website, wfvr.org. Well, it's a beautiful, blustery day outside. I'd say it's looking like an early spring day at the moment, but winter's coming back. Forecast for the weekend has a little snow, a little bit of ice, a little freezing rain, etc. But we're going to play a spring song anyway. This instrumental is called Spring 1, 2012. Max Richter, Daniel Hope, Konzerthaus Kammerchester Berlin, with André de Ridder conducting. Green Zine here, your weekly environmental show for the last 12 years, brought to you today by Soliflect, also by Bale, Royal Trailworks. Someone who was in touch with me this morning, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, the First Branch Coffee Company, Solarfest. That's really going to be happening. More about that later in the show. The White Riverland Collaborative, and Wit and Grit. Stay tuned. We're going to be talking to Ben Edgerly Walsh. We usually talk to him every other year or so, particularly about what's going on with some environmental bills in the Vermont legislature as we've made it past the crossover, and now we're really getting down to the brass tacks part of legislation for the state of Vermont. Well, that probably perked you up for springtime, didn't it, Henry?
Indeed. We got a little bit of snow on the ground last night here in Burlington.
Yeah.
Enough to say it was white.
Yeah, parts of the back roads were sort of frozen without much snow, and then other parts still had snow depending on the condition of the mud or frozen mud or lack thereof. Underneath, I made it down here today, and hopefully I'll make it back home. And I want to welcome you home, Henry, from your travels.
It has been a lovely trip. I went out and visited my daughter and her, Nelia, and her family, Josh and Claire. And they're all thriving out there in a lovely, lovely place in the Pacific Northwest, out on the Olympic Peninsula. And I'll dip right into so my daughter's lived on a sailboat in the South Pacific for some 14, 16 years. And she loves gardening. And she tried gardening on her sailboat. But whenever the storms came up, the plants got destroyed. And so she kind of gave up on it. And now that she's been on a land base for, 11 years or something like that, back there in Port Townsend, she's been gardening up a storm. And she's particularly interested in native species. And she does work for other people as well as doing her own yard. And she basically, we talked a fair amount about this, what's going on out there. And it's going on here, too. We learned about invasive species. And when invasive species, part of the reason they're invasive is that they didn't used to grow there. That's the big part. But they become noticeable when they really thrive in the area that they have moved to, into your area. And when they really thrive, they choke out the native plants. And when you do that, you land up with something much more like a monoculture. Mm. And it turns nature off, and you stop getting birds and bugs and the variety of things that drives nature. And so if you can get rid of the populations of invasives and replace them with native species, the system turns back on again. And I've been looking for someone to talk intelligently about this on our show, but so far I haven't found just the right person. I continue to look week after week. So if anyone's out there listening that knows someone who can spin the tales of just how magic it is, I would love to have them on.
Okay, there's a future guest out there maybe listening, or at least someone's going to let them know to get a hold of Henry. Yeah, we've got to always keep planning ahead, that's for sure.
Yeah, yes, yes. I thought maybe we should visit with our guest a bit early, if we can do that.
Maybe we ought to move
on to Bird Note.
Yeah, we can do
whatever else you've got on your agenda.
Well, I think we're going to do Bird Note, and then I'm noticing, of course, we are partners in a way. We have a media trade agreement with the Herald from Randolph, the White River Valley Herald. We get an ad in their paper every week, and then we acknowledge them here on the air. And I certainly use the paper as a resource because it comes out on Thursday, and I'm hanging around the station for the first half of Thursday. So there's some interesting legislation that's been proposed by a couple local representatives. So maybe we'll hit that after Bird Note. I'm looking at a very beautiful pigeon here on the page, Henry.
Yes, well, it's a pigeon, and it's talking about AI and pigeons. So I think this Bird Note gives us an insight into what AI is really all about, what it can and can't do. I thought this was appropriate in our time of being worried about or concerned ups and downs of embracing artificial intelligence.
Okay, let's see how smart this bird is. You're listening to Green Zine here at WFVR-LP in South Royalton, Vermont.
This is Bird Note. Birds have to be smart to survive, but their minds often work a little differently than ours. A new study reveals that pigeon brains sometimes operate much like a computer's artificial intelligence. In the study, researchers had pigeons identify different types of shapes, pecking a button to give their answers. If they got it right, they received a treat. The pigeons' powerful desire for food helped them fix their mistakes over time. At the start of the experiment, they averaged just 55% correct, only a smidge better than a wild guess. But by the end, they were scoring 95%, an impressive result for a bird. The researchers think these pigeons aren't learning a general rule they can apply in other situations. In other words, the birds haven't learned their shapes like a human child might. They're just using trial and error so they can choose the response that gets them food in this one situation. That's surprisingly similar to how computers learn how to do a task using artificial intelligence. AI picks up skills without learning general rules. Instead, just recognizing patterns to predict an answer. Clearly, we still have a lot to learn from bird brains. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
A regular feature here at Royalton Community Radio. Yeah, very interesting there about AI. Scooping up a lot of data and then using it to get a reward.
Yes. I wonder whether it likes corn or sunflower seeds.
Don't know. We've had quite a few different birds at the bird feeder, took the bird feeder down, the snow came back, put the bird feeder up, and it's probably back down again because folks should know this is now that pretty much snow is mostly gone from the ground, that the bears are waking up. And we don't want the bears visiting your yard. Get them into a bad habit.
Have you seen any two-legged computers running around?
I know some wonky people, but I don't think they want to be called that. No.
Oh. Well, they got hands. I was thinking about the birds among us.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, enough of playing with that one. Yeah.
So, you know, we're going to be talking with Ben Edgerly Walsh, and remind me of the nonprofit. There's so many ones that have V in them, and
so
I get them mixed up.
He's VPIRG.
VPIRG.
And so that's Vermont Public Interest
Research Group. Yeah.
Research Group. And they look at things that are good for the environment and work in the legislature. They're really a lobbying organization to try to educate and convince representatives that this is something they should be paying attention to and trying to come up with a fix for. And I was particularly interested in the legislature over the last multiple years has been putting together a whole series of attempts to fix climate change and many other kind of allied bills as well that are sort of indirect things like getting pollinators to not kill them off so much with neonics and things like that. But there's been climate legislation. Let's see how we can cut down on carbon emissions, and from that there was the formation of the Climate Council,
mm-hmm.
and this was legislation that gave a group of volunteers with the support of facilitation from the government, and it's a board of people made up of private citizens, but also experts in the field and people who are head of government agencies who deal with these issues. So it was a melting pot of people from all different directions. So people who are in charge of utilities, the Agency of Natural Resources, who are appointed by the governor, and the fuel oil dealers and so forth. And it's probably, we'll ask Ben about this, but my guess is there might be 150 people participating in this.
Wow.
Maybe more than that. There's subcommittees and people who just weigh in for a little bit, and other people who are volunteering a lot of time. There's a lot of unpaid people working on this. And we've done a reasonable job with electricity. It isn't perfect, but it's pretty good. We haven't begun to meet our goals for transportation, for decarbonizing transportation, nor for
housing.
Decarbonizing our homes.
Yep.
And the decarbonization of homes, and for that matter, transportation, can come from two different directions. One is to actually get off of fossil fuels, but perhaps equally important is becoming more efficient, using less heat to heat your house because you've made it tighter, that kind of thing. Driving electric vehicles throws away a heck of a lot less heat and is more efficient than driving a gas-powered vehicle. So if you're just looking at it in units of energy to get you where you're going, electric cars are perhaps 2 to 3 times more efficient than a gasoline car in terms of units of energy in and miles down the road.
Yeah.
So anyway, so that's so there is a bill which the Republicans now have not a majority still, but the independents and Democrats no longer have veto proof ability to override the governor's veto if the governor chooses to veto things. And with the a lot of people have retired who were working on this, and now there's a new slate of people, and they've introduced a bill, House 289, and I particularly want to get into that and talk with Ben about that, because that the governor's office over the years have come up with very similar goals to what the Climate Council and the legislature had for goals, but they saw different ways of doing it. And that House 289 is basically takes any teeth away from the Climate Council and makes them into an advisory body only.
Yeah.
Whereas right now, if the legislature or if the state does not meet its climate goals that it has set for itself, the state is allowed to be sued for not having met those goals and to be held accountable for taking action and making it happen, and we certainly haven't made it happen with regards to housing and transportation.
Right. So we'll have to query Ben about that. In fact, Henry, why don't you see if you can round up Ben Edgerly Walsh? I'm going to bring you down in the mix. Remind people that they're listening to Green Zine here at Royalton Community Radio. I'm going to put a little music from Canada on right now. This is a gavotte from Adviel Que Para from Quebec. And speaking of legislation, if you pick up the White River Valley Herald, you'll notice that during legislative session, they print a bunch of information about bills. It's under Capital Journal, and you'll find it on page A2 of this week's Herald. And I wanted to mention a few bills that have to do with the environment. A representative from Orange, Washington, and Addison, and that would include the town of Randolph, that would be Larry Satkowicz, has presented a bill that would ban the use and sale of anticoagulant rodenticides, particularly in ecologically sensitive areas, except under controlled exemptions. Also further down, the representative for Royalton and Tunbridge, John O'Brien, has introduced a bill making state lands available for farming by members of state-recognized Native American tribes. Also, kind of in an environmentally related bill, Representative O'Brien has introduced co-sponsored H. Bill 345, which seeks to ban the sale and distribution of glitter. We don't have glitter in Vermont, do we? Containing synthetic polymer microparticles. I hope that Carol Langstaff is listening. I'm sure she supports that bill. I'm going to go down a little bit further. I know that Representative Suprenant has proposed a couple of agricultural bills. Here's one. Representative Heather Suprenant, Democrat from the Windsor, has introduced Bill H-386. It seeks to establish an agricultural land transfer assistance program to aid in farmland sales and maintenance. And here's one more down here. Actually, two more. House Bill 401, supported by Representatives Suprenant and White, seeks that would be Kirk White, seeks exemptions for small-scale food manufacturers from certain licensing requirements. And the final bill that we'll touch on is House Bill 403, once again introduced by Representative Suprenant, aims to repeal wage exemptions for agricultural workers and ensure adequate housing standards. There's a little mix of farming and housing. I'm going to bring the gavotte down. Boy, that's a fast-moving gavotte that just seems like it took up 15 minutes of the show. It was so fast. Let's see if Henry's been able to connect with our guest. Are you there, Henry?
Yeah, I'm here, and I Ben has not picked up his phone. So we could move on to some other things that are coming up, and then I can try him again. Does that be good?
Yeah, we can do that. You know, I'm just going to, yeah, why don't you try him again, and I'm going to bring you down in the mix, and I'll come back to you. These are some stories that I recommend if you're already getting the New York Times, and I'm not saying that you should. I would urge you, as far as local media, to support the Herald there, the White River Valley Herald, and radio stations like this one. But if you are broadening your scope nationally, the New York Times does put out, usually at the end of the week, usually on a Friday, a piece called Climate Forward. In fact, this piece is from March 23rd. And they have several stories that you can dig deeper into. So I'm just going to kind of give you the headlines, and we might touch base a little deeper on some of them. Trump administration aims to eliminate, there's been a lot of eliminating going on in Washington, eliminating the Environmental Protection Agency's scientific research arm. Here's a story that made front page news in a lot of places. Yeah, lawyers are involved. Jury orders Greenpeace to pay pipeline company more than $660 million. That has to do with a story that was very prominent a few years ago. Native Americans and others, but primarily indigenous folks out in South Dakota, protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline. And that went on for months and months, including during the winter. And now a jury has ordered this nonprofit that's been around for a really long time to come up with $660 million. That's not happening. There's no way that Greenpeace has that kind of money. And I think there will be an appeal. But I guess it all may end up, just like most things today, in the courts. Here's an interesting story. Environmental issues aren't always a partisan divide, with one side saying, I'm for all environmental bills, and another side saying, I'm totally against them. This is a national, the Republicans, a lot of them, are pushing Trump to save Biden's clean energy tax credits. A lot of those credits have benefited primarily, at least in the majority, red states. And if they are taken away, A lot of jobs could be at stake in those red states. So that's some interesting reading where maybe some hands can be joined across the aisle. Story here on Want Cheap Power Fast, solar and wind firms have a suggestion. And then towards the bottom of this list, Earth's 10 hottest years on record are the last 10 in a row. That's not too surprising. EPA investigations of severe pollution look increasingly at risk, mainly because there's been a lot of layoffs there at the EPA. Government science data may soon be hidden. They're racing to copy it. That's something that we've talked about here on the air, and there are a lot of people trying to save that data before it gets either erased or hidden. And then there's a photo that you can look at. Here's what the rise of clean energy looks like from space. So that's just a little touch on what's going on in the section that comes out on a weekly basis, normally at the end of the week, called Climate Forward from the New York Times. So, Henry, have you had any luck?
Nope. I'm still getting, I've sent him text message asking him to call me when he comes up for air. I expect he's gotten interrupted. So I have,
we can move to that other piece,
and I have a piece that you don't know about, which is in the notes.
A
now.
Secret piece.
So
nice.
Catherine Hayhoe, actually, in a recent, broadcast, put out some, what to me is very relieving news. Brought in Dr. Frederica Otto, who is a climate scientist from Europe, and she is responsible for having led the charge on making it so that there's statistical significance for saying how likely this storm we just had is due to global warming. So that's something that the weather forecasters danced around for years because they didn't have science for it and never really wanted to blame warming for that. There's Ben. Let me take him. And anyway, she says that the things are not tipping over right away. We have time to fix climate. We just need to do it.
Okay.
So here's Ben.
All right. Let's see if he jumps right in. And if not, there's always music. Some more music from Advaita Para. You're listening to Green Zine, Royalton Community Radio. Let's bring that down and see if Henry and Ben are with us.
Yes. Ben Walsh from VPIRG. Welcome to Green Scene. Appreciate you having you on again.
Thank you so much. It's good to be back.
Yeah, always good to have you on. Ben, I think we're up to maybe in the last 10 years or so, 3 or 4 visits from you, and we're really looking forward to an update about what's going on up there under the Golden Dome.
Yeah, happy to provide one. I will take it away, Henry. What do you want to know?
Well, let's try and sort out whether I've given a little bit of background on the Republicans' bill H-289, which kind of still is trying to attempt the same things that the legislature has been trying to attempt past years, but would take the power away from the Climate Council and give it to the governor's office, to the administration. Am I right in that? as it's currently written?
That's certainly one of the core things it would do. It's a lot more expansive than that. It's really a package of rollbacks on climate action that the governor's proposed. It certainly would undermine in a whole host of ways the Global Warming Solutions Act. What you just described is one of those ways, really it would reduce the number of climate counselors. It in particular would eliminate the climate council seat for someone with expertise in data analysis and sort of energy and climate, and the seat for an individual with expertise in designing programs to reduce climate pollution. So, I think that the fact that those two seats are two that they targeted indicate to me that they're not terribly serious about actually reducing climate pollution. Yeah, and yes, it would consolidate, the power, the majority of the seats in the executive branch rather than the balance between the House, the Senate, and the executive that exists now. But beyond that, it essentially eliminates Vermont's climate pollution reduction requirements, replaces them with a much mushier goal for the mid-2030s, which really wouldn't be so much about reducing climate pollution. It's just sort of counting up the sequestration our farms and forests are mounting to and saying we're sort of good. We don't really need to reduce pollution too much. And then beyond that, it also would really undermine the renewable energy standard that was updated last year, in particular pushing renewables out of Vermont and the jobs that come with them. It's concerned for a whole host of ways. I've only sort of touched on the most important planks of it, but at the end of the day, it's a package of climate rollbacks, and that's not what we should be doing as a state.
Hey, can I just jump in and ask you about the last point that you made about possibly by sort of watering down the renewable energy standard, how that would take place, hopefully it doesn't, and how that does push jobs and have less renewable energy in the state?
Well, it's really adding up a few different provisions in the bill. It would attempt to put smaller in-state renewables on the same playing field as larger out-of-state renewables, and that sort of necessarily would drive renewables out of the state because we have a ban on wind in the state. And for all practical terms, the very lowest cost renewables aren't available to us in Vermont. And solar in Vermont has really come down in price. It is actually very affordable, but it's still not as cheap as a large wind farm up in the county in Maine, for instance. That's one piece. It also has a provision that kind of boils down to if you have to have transmission or distribution upgrades, upgrades to the electric grid to build a renewable energy plant, that would essentially be verboten now. So it's a few things that you sort of, if you just read the words on the page in isolation, they might not seem like a big deal, but you stack them together and it would really reduce the amount of renewables being built in Vermont under the law. Right now, under again, this law that was updated just last year, by the early mid-2030s, 20% of the electricity in Vermont would need to come from newly constructed renewables here in Vermont. That's up from 10% under the old law. And under H289, were it to pass, it would push a lot of that to larger out-of-state renewables. That's a problem financially because, you wouldn't have people living here in Vermont building those plants. But it also is a problem from our perspective, from a responsibility standpoint. Like, if we're using electricity, we have a responsibility to have more of it come from plants here in Vermont. And this is, far from saying all of it needs to come in Vermont. It's just a reasonable amount.
Right.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting right now the state gets almost 50% of its power from Hydro-Québec. And if this trade war thing goes along, there's been, rumblings about whether Hydro-Québec or whether the Canadians might just decide to shut off their exports. And And I doubt that'll really come about, but nonetheless, it does make you realize that if that were to happen, that we would sort of be hanging out there, scratching our head about exactly where we got our power from for electricity, and certainly for the people that heat their houses with natural gas. That's, again, a Canadian company that is coming from Canada, all that natural gas coming into the state, and quite separate about of whether it is fracked or not fracked, or whether it's more or less efficient for environmental reasons. It just would be a horrendous shock if it were to get turned off. There would be a lot of plug-in space heaters or something trying to make up the difference while people scramble to find a new, install propane to replace their natural gas or whatever.
I will say briefly, I think you're right. The shutoff scenario is extremely unlikely, but we are in a situation where we're very exposed to the actions of President Trump. And, frankly, I think our local leadership here should be really leaning in on energy independence and a diversity of sources of energy. And, that's part of why we were so excited to see the Renewable Energy Standard updated last year to require more renewables from here in Vermont. We're thinking about energy from our perspective. A more stable energy system is going to come from a diversity of renewable sources, small and large, near and far, wind, solar, hydro. You really don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. And I think this law would move us, in that direction. And so, frankly, it's disappointing to see, Governor Scott really, taking a very similar tack to President Trump on climate. Their approaches are very different. Their personalities certainly seem to be very different, though I don't know either man personally. But when you look at what happened last time around when President Trump was elected, Governor Scott said, I know, the president's pulling us back, from climate action, but Vermont's still in. We're going to keep on doing it. This time around, instead, Governor Scott saying, here's all the climate action that I'd like to get rid of in Vermont. And then the last thing I'd say on 2D9, and I want to give you all a chance to ask me more questions. One of the central planks of H289 is we're going to roll back all of these climate actions, and what we're going to replace them with is an 18-month planning process where after the next election, we're going to come back and we're going to propose some things, and then everything will be fine, as if another plan after the current climate plan that's being updated right now, the climate plan from 2 years ago, the climate plan that Governor Scott's own Climate Action Commission proposed in 2018, we know what we need to do. We just need to actually do it. So it's really disappointing that they're trying to kick the can down the road yet again.
Now, go ahead, Henry. Then I've got all kinds of questions. Go ahead.
So I think that part of the governor's stated fear is that these climate goals that are set with teeth in them, saying you really have to do them, that he's worried about it being very expensive. And I was listening to some of the testimony before the House Energy and Infrastructure Committee. And I at the tail end of that, I heard one of the members of the Climate Council say, well, we could figure out a funding mechanism that made it so that this was an individual choice and was not forcing a lot of cost on the state or on the utilities, because it is actually cheaper to drive down the road in an electric vehicle than it is in a gas vehicle, if you look at the life of the vehicle. And it is cheaper to heat your hot water with heat pumps instead of a gas hot water heater, and on and on. And if we could come up with a system, and two of them were named, but and I think this is to be discussed, but if you come up with a system where people could replace what they're doing with something else and then pay for it out of the savings, kind of a bank mm-hmm. account, a low-interest loan that would get you there, that this doesn't have to have state cost involved, and individuals can make their own decision. And that just sounds to me so much like a win-win to move ahead. Have you heard any more thinking on that? And do you think that the governor would still be in the veto mode on that one?
Well, I would say, the kind of program that you're talking about is something that already exists and certainly could be expanded in Vermont. I think that would be a win for sure. But I don't think that by itself would be, sufficient to, ensure that this transition happens as rapidly as, frankly, it needs to. And it needs to under Vermont law. But, let's be real about what we're talking about here. It needs to based on the science of climate change and the pace at which we all know we need to reduce our pollution. But the other thing that's really important to understand about this transition in the energy space that's happening, across all types of energy, not just electricity, but as you say, electric vehicles and the heating space, it's happening right now. Actually, there was data from the Inflation Reduction Act, the law that included a lot of different tax credits for measures like the ones we're talking about, that showed Vermont actually adopting these sorts of technologies at a much faster pace than almost any other state. And that's fantastic. But we also know
Still not fast enough.
That's true. But actually, I was going in a different direction with it. We know that these things are being adopted more quickly by upper middle income and upper income Americans generally, people in the world generally. And that is good that they're doing it, good for the planet, good for their pocketbooks. But as a society, from our perspective, we have a responsibility to make sure that everyone can be part of this transition and we're not leaving people with fewer resources to begin with behind and getting these benefits more slowly. And so that's why we've been so focused on things that make this transition more viable for low and moderate income Vermonters. We're seeing some of those programs run out of money and no real replacement be proposed by the Scott administration, which is incredibly frustrating, especially since they've really started to see much faster adoption, which is, I think, exactly the wrong time to turn off the help that we're giving low and moderate income Vermonters in this transition.
So I guess I'm going to keep the affordability factor in here. And we know that in this recent election, that word was used by both sides, but particularly successfully by some incoming Republicans. Still at both the House and Senate level, politically, those who may side with the policies that Governor Scott is proposing this term they're not at 50-50 with the independents, the progressives, and the Democrats. In fact, they might be not even quite a third of the legislature. So is this affordability argument? First of all, if we were to adopt more in-state renewable energy, and we're looking down the road and trying to stay on track with the original plan of the Global Warming Solutions Act, is there any argument, I think there probably could be, that the savings to the state over 10 years with that track are going to be much more than kind of beholden to outside energy sources like we are with Hydro-Québec, where price spikes could happen. There's a war in Europe, there's, big shutdown, et cetera. So on that, but then to go back politically, how nervous, for Scott to pass, he's going to need a majority. So this, we're not talking about overriding a veto. We're saying that enough Democrats, independents, progressives need to cross over to vote for his bills. Does that seem like a reality based on this affordability argument?
Well, let me just answer that last question in terms of what are the prospects for something like this climate rollback package actually moving forward? I don't think they're good. I think there are enough legislators that understand how essential both climate action and energy affordability are. You know, certainly we have our case to make to the legislature, and they've been hearing a lot from Vermonters. There was a state senator who mentioned a few weeks ago, there was one day where they got 500 calls into the state house opposing any rollbacks on climate action. So that's very encouraging. And Vermonters very clearly understand the need for this, or at least, you know, on the whole, majority of Vermonters do. Getting to the question that you're asking, the suite of questions you were touching on around affordability, you know, I think there's a couple of different ways of thinking about it, different sort of schools of thought. I would characterize, and I'm not going to be generous to the other side of this argument here. You can have them on if you want to hear their perspective from their own mouth. But, you know, essentially the other side is saying we need to sit on our hands and not do anything, because if we do something, it might cost money, and that is bad. We don't want to spend money because that has obviously a cost. And so the affordability agenda coming from that side is just let the fossil fuel market play out the way it's going to play out, and Vermonters will keep on burning them, and they'll keep on paying however much they have to pay. But we're not going to add anything to that. Our perspective, the perspective of people who understand that energy affordability and climate action really are tied at the hip, and pointing very much in the same direction in terms of the actions you need to take, is the worst thing we can do is leave Vermonters exposed to fossil fuels, which are very frequently expensive and certainly very volatile in their prices. You mentioned, you know, war in Europe. When Putin invaded Ukraine, Vermonters' energy bills just to heat their homes went up $1,500 for a winter overnight. That's not a cost that most Vermont families can easily absorb. And so moving towards more affordable, more stably priced energy options in the heating and transportation sector, which, let's be clear about what we're talking about here, electricity really is both of those things. For all that we're potentially exposed to tariffs from our imports of electricity from Hydro-Quebec, it is unbelievably clear that electricity is more affordable and more stable in terms of its price here in Vermont than heating oil, propane, you know, gasoline, diesel, et cetera. And so from our perspective, abandoning climate action is abandoning a move towards energy affordability.
Yeah. So let me just bring up the House 125. And I understand, I haven't looked at that really carefully, but I understand that that is an attempt to cap people's energy out-of-pocket costs and to pay attention to the low and middle-income people who spend a much bigger percentage of their household budget on energy than the more affluent people. Am I right about that? And how do you see that moving forward? Is that going to make it through the process?
I think you may be thinking of a different bill. Let me touch on one thing that is happening that's sort of in that can we cap energy costs in particular for low and moderate income Vermonters, that, you know, that space.
Excellent.
Let me touch on 125, because it is actually a valuable move, although a fairly modest one. So last year there was a law that passed that required the Public Utilities Commission it might have been another state regulator, but essentially to come up with recommendations around how to best cap or reduce electric bills for low and moderate income Vermonters. There are a number of different ways to approach that. There are some modest programs in Vermont right now. If you're a Green Mountain Power customer, for instance, if you're very low income, you can receive a rate reduction on your electric rate. So anyway, there's going to be more information on that coming out later this year for potential action next legislative session. Back to H-125, though, you know, that's essentially a bill that is attempting to consolidate the information the legislature has around this energy transition so that the legislature can make better, more well-informed decisions. So it's you know, everything from, you know, the size and location of, you know, solar electric facilities around the state, gas station pumps, electric vehicle charging infrastructure, heating fuel deliveries on down the line, to really understand, are there geographic disparities in terms of Vermonters' access to energy broadly and clean energy in particular? And obviously, if you have that information, you can act to reduce any geographic disparities so that you don't have rural Vermonters having a harder time transitioning to, say, electric vehicles than Vermonters in Chittenden County. Nobody wants that, and there's not a very clear answer to exactly, you know, to what degree those sorts of disparities exist right now. And so, you know, that's essentially, as I understand it, what this bill is trying to get at. And I do believe that it'll move through the process.
Excellent. Yeah. So, Todd, we've got to move on and let Ben go. Or Ben, do you have to go? We can probably.
I have a few more minutes, but if you need to move on with your show, please. I don't want to get in the way of that.
No, okay. I think you've given us a pretty thorough overview up there, and I'm glad that the public is checking in by phone. And when some of these bills actually get out of, you know, they've made the crossover to either the House or back to the Senate, and they come to a full vote, I think people ought to be ready to call the sergeant at arms, be aware of who their representatives are, and on very important committees, and make the voice of the people be heard. And try to keep what a lot of work's been done by a lot of legislators and nonprofits and citizens to put us in a position where we can hopefully get back on track for reducing our fossil fuel emissions in all of those sectors. And I'm really appreciative of the work that you do, Ben, with your colleagues there at VPIRG. And thanks for joining us here.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And thanks for all the work that you do.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right, Henry, we've got actually closer to 8 minutes left in the show. We did bring up EVs a little bit there and the role that they play. And just a couple quick thick things. And once again, to go back to local media, this is from the Herald. Tri-Valley Transit is reporting, and this is strange things are happening with grants and money that was thought to be going to the states and maybe is being blocked. Tri-Valley Transit has been working on getting some electric smaller vans, and they do have one over in Bradford that they have been able to secure. And they do have funds, but they're kind of those funds that might disappear based on some decisions being made down in Washington. And the good news at the moment, if you read this article in today's Herald, is that the green light has been given, that the funds are still available, and that some more EV vans, smaller vans, one of the difficulties not only in being sure of the funding, but also getting the right type of van. In our area, 15 to 20 passenger vans that are specifically built for vans are hard to get. A lot of the small buses that you see are actually on truck bodies, probably using more energy. So sourcing the proper van is a little bit of a challenge. But the good news is it looks like some of these commuter vans for people who don't necessarily need to have their own vehicle, but could go down to Route 110 or regular stops. I know the TVT stops here at the law school and know the schedule and just get on the electric van and take them to their shopping or take them up to Montpelier, take them down to West Lebanon, etc. So that's a good news. And then another story about EVs, and this is not surprising. A lot of EV battery manufacturing and even vehicle manufacturing is happening in the South and particularly in the Mid-South. And if you were thinking of moving there, and we don't want you to move away, but of course the range and of EVs in warmer temperatures and road conditions is much improved if you are south of the Mason-Dixon line. So that's just a couple things on EVs. Henry, I got something else on a different topic, but I'm going to throw it back to you.
Yeah, I continue to enjoy the feeling of my car not having to put gasoline in it. It really just is like fingernails on a blackboard when I have to use a fossil fuel when I wouldn't have to. And I might say, you know, I still haven't spent a lot of time with my EV, but I've really enjoyed it so far. And I went for a technology that was not very modern. You know, the charging rate on my car is not nearly as fast as vehicles that are more recent. It's really something that Kia has actually discontinued that model and moved to a better vehicle. And I went for it because of price and availability and ground clearance. And the, what am I trying to say? Anyway.
So just, I'll touch off on that. I've always got something else to say about EVs. Another major EV manufacturer, and we'll keep names below the radar screen, has announced efforts to make much smaller EVs. That's been a challenge. Smaller kind of commuter, urban, suburban cars that don't have to have such as big a battery. They would be much less expensive. They would use less precious materials. They're still probably 2 to 3 years away from rolling those out. And here locally, I can announce that the Tunbridge Select Board did accept a bid the other night to build out the solar project that will be up to just under 15 kilowatts there out at the town garage. And that is due to get underway, I believe, in late April or May, and probably be done by the length of the summer. So a lot of energy from the sun coming to the town buildings, particularly the two town buildings, the town offices and the town hall in Tunbridge. And those,
I want to thank you, Todd, for that effort to keep that percolating and make it happen, because that's really good to get some more solar happening in a place that is not annoying to have it and so forth.
Well, you're very welcome. And, of course, a tip of the hat to the Energy Clinic at the Vermont Law Graduate School, particularly to Kurt Mayland and Sherrod, a second-year student there. Actually, she's a master's student, I believe. And then they're actually working on a proposal to kind of oversee the weatherization. Not that they would be doing the work, but just trying to keep tabs on contractors and stuff. So there is some good news out there in the environment. Don't go too much the gloom and doom. Henry, do you recognize this piece of music? Can you hear it?
Yeah, I barely. Yes, it sounds like that helps.
Well, of course, a Quaker hymn coming out. "'Tis a gift to be simple, but Appalachian spring. Spring is coming.
It is a gift to be simple.
Yes, and more, of course, more sunshine coming. Go ahead.
So I have in the notes there are references to two books that I have been dipping into while I've been gone, and Society's Breakthrough, Releasing the Essential Wisdom of Virtue in All People, being able to take part in that, of running society, and Utopia for Realists, and their notes there for both of those. That's a delightful and read and packed full of examples of what really works to fix the world instead of the things we think might work to fix the world. So it's quite a fascinating read.
Great.
And just a quick note, I remember what it was. So there's an EV maker in China who has come up with 5-minute charge.
BYD.
So that allows you. And there is and I discovered there's an EV maker in Europe that is doing a 6-minute charge and has already has those out in the European market. And what that does, it allows you to have smaller batteries because it's a quick top up, and so that changes the nature of EV vehicles when you start to think of them as not having to take much time to charge.
It reduces range anxiety. Well, we're not getting anxious here at the radio station. You've been listening to Green Zine with Henry Swayze and myself, Todd Tyson, at WFVR-LP, South Royalton. Democracy Now! Coming up next. And then, In My Bones with Rebecca, and then some classical music after that, similar to what we're hearing now from Aaron Copland. We do want to thank our underwriters here on Green Zine. They include Soloflect, Bail, Royal Trailworks, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, Solarfest, the White Riverland Collaborative, and Wit and Grit. Henry, look forward to speaking with you next week.
See you all next week.
Very good.